Knowledge Products presents Karl Marx, Das Kapital, Part 5.
When we listen to Marx's denunciations of capitalism, we should never forget that he always thinks of capitalism as a society of astounding achievements and a necessary stage in human progress. But he considers capitalism to be unstable and doomed. He sees capitalism as a sometimes magnificent, sometimes horrendous system with a short lifespan. Marx believes that his approach is superior to that of the bourgeois economists, as he calls them, who mistakenly suppose that the fundamental framework of capitalism is timeless. According to Marx, capitalism is a brief prelude to communism, lasting at most a few hundred years. Furthermore, capitalism is not static. It is continually transforming itself under the impact of market competition and technological innovation. There are three features of capitalism which Marx constantly hammers home. First, capitalism is anarchical. In other words, it is unplanned. Second, under capitalism, the scale of organization is always getting larger. Small firms are displaced by bigger firms. Big firms are displaced by giant corporations and cartels, and these gigantic organizations are displaced by the state. Third, capitalism produces a large, disciplined, united, and thoroughly miserable working class, or proletariat, who become steadily worse off. The members of the proletariat feel shut out from any control over their destiny, even though, according to Marx, these workers are the indispensable people, the people who keep capitalism going. Lack of planning, increasing scale of organization, and a powerful but disaffected working class. If these three features of capitalism persist, then capitalism cannot have long to live. Marx frequently accuses capitalism of making the poor suffer, and occasionally he accuses it of bringing out the worst in people by appealing to their most selfish motives. There is nothing unusual in these criticisms coming from a 19th century intellectual. What is distinctive about Marx is the enormous emphasis he lays on the unplanned, spontaneous, anarchic, irrational nature of capitalism.
Within capitalist production, there is much waste, because nothing is undertaken according to a social plan, but everything depends on the infinitely different conditions, means, etc., with which the individual capitalist operates. This results in a great waste of the productive forces.
There are many occasions where Marx uses the words anarchy or anarchical to describe capitalism, as contrasted with the planned organization of communism.
The capitalist mode of production, while on the one hand enforcing economy in each individual business, on the other hand begets, by its anarchical system of competition, the most outrageous squandering of labor power and of the social means of production.
When Marx refers to the planned nature of communism and the unplanned or anarchical nature of capitalism, he is, of course, aware that there is a great deal of planning going on inside capitalism. But it is not planning of the whole economy, merely planning of small portions of the whole economy. Marx considers that defenders of capitalism are caught in an embarrassing contradiction, since they praise conscious organization or planning within the firm and within each of the firm's departments, yet they still oppose planning of the whole of industry. Defenders of capitalism praise lack of planning in the total pattern of relationships between firms. Marx can see no reason why someone who praises design and deliberate forethought within a firm should wish for firms to be independent of central control, or even to exist as separate entities at all. In this extract from Marx's Capital, notice Marx's use of the word bourgeois. This is a French word originally meaning middle class, but Marx uses it as another word for capitalist.
Division of labor within the workshop implies the undisputed authority of the capitalist over men that are but parts of a mechanism that belongs to him. Division of labor within society brings into contact independent commodity producers who acknowledge no other authority than that of competition. Just as in the animal kingdom, the warfare of each against all preserves the conditions of existence of every species. The same bourgeois mind which praises division of labor in the workshop, lifelong annexation of the laborer to a partial operation, and his complete subjection to capital, that same bourgeois mind denounces with equal vigor every conscious attempt to socially control and regulate the process of production as an inroad upon such sacred things as the rights of property, freedom, and unrestricted play for the bent of the individual capitalist. It is very characteristic that the enthusiastic apologists of the factory system have nothing more damning to urge against the general organization of the labor of society than that it would turn all society into one immense factory.
The possibility that there might be limits to the size and scope of effective centralized management, that beyond a certain scale, conscious planning may become unwieldy, never occurs to Marx. Marx understands that the relations between the independent enterprises in a capitalist system are not completely chaotic. In fact, his labor theory of value is designed precisely to account for the order which emerges from market competition, even though nobody planned it. But Marx has no doubt that capitalism must be wasteful and inefficient because it is not subject to a single supreme overall plan. Not only does Marx think that this is inefficient, he also thinks that it is an insult to human dignity. He finds something degrading in the fact that within a market economy, important things happen not because they were consciously willed, but simply as the incidental result of individuals pursuing their own advantage. In Marx's Capital, religion is often used as a metaphor of capitalism.
The laborer exists to satisfy the needs of self-expansion of existing values, instead of, on the contrary, material wealth existing to satisfy the needs of development on the part of the laborer. As in religion, man is governed by the products of his own brain, so in capitalist production, he is governed by the products of his own hand.
In his youth, Marx had been influenced by the atheist philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, who argued that man lived a wretched, stunted life and projected all his fine and unattainable goals onto an imaginary being, God. In worshiping God, a product of his own imagination which had gotten out of control, man was worshiping his own fine potentialities, which in the real world existed only in a thwarted and crippled form. Marx later applied this idea to capitalism. In worshiping money and profit, man is worshiping his own enormous potential for productive work, a potential which is thwarted and crippled by the market.
A commodity is a mysterious thing, simply because in it the social character of men's labor appears to them as an objective character, stamped upon the product of that labor. Because the relation of the producers to the sum total of their own labor is presented to them as a social relation existing not between themselves, but between the products of their labor. In order to find an analogy, we must have recourse to the mist-enveloped regions of the religious world. In that world, the productions of the human brain appear as independent beings, endowed with life and entering into relations, both with one another and with the human race. So it is in the world of commodities with the products of men's hands. This I call the fetishism which attaches itself to the products of labor as soon as they are produced as commodities.
Here, Marx is using the word commodity in his own special sense of an object produced for sale on the market. Capitalism, according to Marx, is the highest development, the fullest flowering of production for the market, therefore of commodity production. In communism, the market and money will be eliminated. So in Marx's sense of the term, there will be no commodities under communism. In order to present this picture of commodity fetishism, of human beings apparently placing themselves at the beck and call of inanimate objects, Marx employs not only fantastic metaphor, but also irony. Thus, Capital opens with a discussion of the relationships between commodities, as though the behavior of commodities were independent of the wishes of their human owners.
A commodity appears at first sight a very trivial thing and easily understood. Its analysis shows that it is in reality a very queer thing, abounding in metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties. The form of wood, for instance, is altered by making a table out of it. Yet, for all that, the table continues to be that common, everyday thing, wood. But as soon as it steps forth as a commodity, it is changed into something transcendent. It not only stands with its feet on the ground, but in relation to all other commodities, it stands on its head and evolves out of its wooden brain grotesque ideas far more wonderful than table turning ever was.
We should bear in mind Mark Twain's remark that a German joke is no laughing matter. Marx's use of irony and elaborately fantastic metaphor has misled many readers. For example, Marx often writes of the labor time which has been embodied or congealed or crystallized in commodities. And some readers have taken this too seriously. Marx is very clear that the past history of a commodity can never have the slightest effect upon its value or its price. The relevant labor time is that which would be required now to reproduce a new commodity of the type in question. This labor time is entirely governed by social necessity, in other words, by market demand.
Suppose that every piece of linen in the market contains no more labor time than is socially necessary. In spite of this, all these pieces taken as a whole may have had superfluous labor time spent upon them. If the market cannot stomach the whole quantity at the normal price of 2 shillings a yard, this proves that too great a portion of the total labor of the community has been expended in the form of weaving.
What Marx is driving at with his talk about commodity fetishism is that under capitalism, as he sees it, neither the worker nor the capitalist is consciously striving to improve production or human well-being. They are both pursuing money, the worker in order to live, and the capitalist in order to accumulate ever larger quantities of capital. The worker is not interested in the aims or broad significance of his work. He usually hates his work. He does it merely in order to live. The capitalist is, for Marx, someone consumed by the passion to accumulate. This passion, however, is forced upon him. It is the only way he can survive as a capitalist.
The capitalist shares with the miser the passion for wealth as wealth. But that which in the miser is mere idiosyncrasy is in the capitalist the effect of the social mechanism of which he is but one of the wheels. Competition makes the immanent laws of capitalist production to be felt by each individual capitalist as external, coercive laws. It compels him to keep constantly extending his capital in order to preserve it. But extend it he cannot, except by means of progressive accumulation. Accumulate, accumulate, that is Moses and the prophets. Save, save, reconvert the greatest possible portion of surplus value into capital.
Marx seems to be overeager to jump to the conclusion that capitalists can survive only by expansion. Some capitalist firms go on indefinitely without increasing greatly in size. As experience since Marx has shown, this phenomenon is not a temporary lag or hangover, but a settled, permanent aspect of capitalism. Furthermore, Marx presents the capitalist concern with growth in the value of his assets as something cruel and menacing. But the value of any capital asset reflects the future income which will flow from it. In other words, the value of capital arises from expected future benefit to consumers of its products. By striving for profitability, the capitalist is acting on behalf of the consumers. And when in search of profits, the capitalist makes a decision which causes discomfort to his employees, it is the pressure of consumers' wants which is ultimately responsible for that discomfort. Naturally, Marx recognizes this fact, though he considers that the consumers' wants are transmitted in a very rough and ready way because of inequalities in income and the anarchic nature of the market. But Marx is impressed by the fact that the capitalist is not directly or necessarily preoccupied with satisfying human wants, but with the intervening goal of expanding asset values. And Marx finds this disgusting and obnoxious. In listening to the following passage from Marx's Capital, notice two peculiarities of Marx's language. First, unlike most economists who use the word capital to mean equipment such as machines, buildings, railroads, and so forth, Marx employs the word capital to mean such equipment only when it is used to extract surplus value by exploiting wage workers. Second, Marx describes such capital equipment as dead labor. So when an engineer uses a lathe, for example, this is living labor using dead labor.
The capitalist is only capital personified. His soul is the soul of capital. But capital has one single life impulse, the tendency to create value and surplus value, to make the means of production absorb the greatest possible amount of surplus labor. Capital is dead labor, that vampire-like, lives only by sucking living labor, and lives the more labor it sucks.
Elsewhere in Capital, Marx writes of the werewolf's hunger for surplus labor and the vampire thirst for the living blood of labor. Marx's horrific vision of capitalism is of a world where the creations of men's hands and brains appear to turn round and enslave their creators. Instead of workers associating together and deciding among themselves how to use equipment to produce useful goods, the equipment seems to make the decisions and to drag the workers into its clutches. Of course, this is only figurative. Marx's real point is that the market is not under conscious control. It is an automatic process which produces uncontrolled outcomes that constrain the way individuals behave. In Marx's figurative language, dead labor feeds on living labor. Marx does not believe that the capitalist as an individual is evil or immoral. The capitalist, like the worker, is in the grip of forces he cannot understand or control.
Capital is reckless of the health or length of life of the laborer, unless under compulsion from society. In response to the outcry against physical and mental degradation, premature death, and the torture of overwork, capital replies, ought these matters to trouble us, since they increase our profits? But looking at things as a whole, all this does not depend on the good or ill will of the individual capitalist. Free competition brings out the inherent laws of capitalist production in the shape of external, coercive laws with power over every individual capitalist.
Marx did not recommend to individuals within capitalism that they should behave differently from the way he describes them as behaving. Marx himself was virtually a capitalist. He derived most of his income from his friend Frederick Engels, who had an interest in a Manchester textile firm. In Marx's early days in London, he had to make do with very little by the standards of his well-to-do family background and upbringing. Later, Engels settled a regular annuity on Marx, who was then able to live comfortably on the loot which Engels had gotten by exploiting the Manchester workers. Studies have been made of Marx's income and expenditures. They show that his average income was several times that of a well-paid factory worker. But Marx was a man of disorganized personal habits, a heavy drinker and cigar smoker, and he liked to keep up the appearances of a middle-class existence, partly in the hope of making good marriages for his daughters. So he always had trouble making ends meet. From Marx's point of view, there was nothing ironic about his situation as a capitalist champion of the workers against the capitalists. From the 1840s on, he always stressed that it was important for individual capitalists to support the working class and the communist revolution. Contrary to what is often claimed, Marx never suggested that individuals always follow their class interests, or that what class a person is in determines the way he or she thinks. The irrational anarchy of capitalism is, for Marx, most clearly demonstrated in the phenomenon of the business cycle. It is one of the disappointments of Marx's Capital that it does not contain a complete theory of the business cycle. There are many threads, but they are never drawn together. In fact, the range of different business cycle theories among Marxists is just as great as the range of theories among non-Marxist economists, with one exception. Marx and his followers never accept the possibility that the trade cycle is due to government mismanagement, or that it could be cured by appropriate government policies. To Marx, the business cycle arises basically because capitalism is anarchic, and it is the chief proof that this anarchy leads to inefficiency.
The enormous power inherent in the factory system of expanding by jumps and the dependency of that system on the markets of the world necessarily beget feverish production, followed by overfilling of the markets. Thereupon, contraction of the markets brings on crippling of production. The life of modern industry becomes a series of periods of moderate activity, prosperity, overproduction, crisis, and stagnation.
This is the end of part 5. Please download part 6 to continue.